It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. First, we've talked over the years a lot about addiction and substance abuse here on the show. Our next guest says we can learn a lot from addiction treatment about a related problem in our lives, compulsive overconsumption. That could be anything from compulsive shopping, a computer game habit, constantly checking our social media and our phones. What ties all those together? The system of pain and pleasure in our brains and dopamine in particular. We're taking a look now at dopamine and its role in a wide variety of problems, from substance abuse disorders to compulsively checking our phones. In her new book, our next guest says that modern excess has made us all the more vulnerable to addiction and to compulsive behaviors. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have one of these, or have you had one of these experiences, a compulsive behavior? Binge watching shows past the point where it feels healthy, constantly checking social media, eating, you name it. How do they make you feel? Did you find a way to cut down on them? Do you have questions about how all this works in our lives and in our brains? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Anna Lemke is professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford University, chief of the Stanford Addiction Medicine Dual Diagnosis Clinic. She's the author of Dopamine Nation: Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. Dr. Lemke, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
We, as I mentioned, we talk a lot about addiction and substance abuse disorder. I'd like, if you would, for you to introduce this concept of compulsive overconsumption. It's got overlap with what we think of as addiction, but it might involve a lot of activities that we might not think of as addictive. What do we mean by that?
Well, addiction is a spectrum disorder, and it is possible to be a little bit addicted, which means that we engage in behaviors in a compulsive, out-of-control way that is ultimately not in line with our goals and values, and may even be harming us and other people. And this can apply not just to things that we put in our bodies, including food, but can also apply to behaviors, things like gambling, shopping, pornography, masturbation, video games, social media, cryptocurrency, online chess, you name it. I have probably heard of pretty much every compulsive overconsumption slash addiction type behavior you could imagine. Why? Because we all have the same ancient machinery that has us reflexively approaching pleasure and avoiding pain. It's called the pleasure-pain balance, or at least that's what I call it. And it's wonderfully adapted to a world of scarcity, but not so much for a world of overwhelming overabundance, which is the world we live in now.
Let's open up the hood on that machinery. And one of the key ingredients in the title of your book, dopamine. What is it? Why is it such a big part of this story?
Dopamine is a neurotransmitter. It's a chemical that we make in our brain. It's fundamental to the experience of pleasure, reward, and motivation. It's also important for movement. That's no coincidence. Most organisms have to move to get the reward they want. But humans have been able to engineer our ecosystem so that we can just sit on the couch, swipe right and swipe left, and get our heart's desire. And this is very problematic for the brain, because what happens is that now we're releasing huge amounts of dopamine in the reward pathway very quickly. And that is not what our brains evolved for. And the result is that we're all becoming vulnerable to the problem of addiction, because what our brains do in the presence of these sudden intense spikes of dopamine is that our brains adapt by, in fact, downregulating our own dopamine production and transmission, not just to baseline tonic levels of dopamine firing, but actually below baseline to a dopamine deficit state. That's the come down, the hangover, the after effect. And with repeated exposure to high amounts of dopamine, a fire hose of dopamine, if you will, what essentially happens is we end up in a chronic or long-term dopamine deficit state, which is akin to a clinical depression. And I think that is the reason, or at least part of the reason, why we're seeing increasing rates of anxiety, depression, and suicide all over the world, but especially in rich nations. Of course, trauma, socioeconomic disparity, and many other stressors play a role, but I contend that it is the stress of overwhelming overabundance and the drugification of modern life that is in fact driving our brains to be in a physiologic dopamine deficit state, which feels exactly like depression.
I want to hammer that home a little bit. Let's say I like something like I do computer games. I mostly play them in a healthy way. At points in my life, I've definitely played them too much. That first bit of playing feels nice. I probably get a little bit of that dopamine. But if I keep doing it again and again and again, I can speak from experience. It gets less fun over time. I feel worse about it. That same amount of time spent playing isn't as fun. That's what's going on with that dopamine cycle, in effect.
Exactly. So exposure to highly reinforcing drugs and behaviors over time will in fact change our brain and reset our hedonic or joy set point, such that our pleasure-pain balance becomes chronically tilted to the side of pain. And now we need more and more pleasure, not to feel good, but just to feel normal. And when we're not engaging in our intoxicant, we are in a depressed state, a dopamine deficit state, experiencing the universal symptoms of withdrawal from any addictive substance, which are anxiety, irritability, insomnia, dysphoria, and craving.
Talking to Dr. Anna Lemke, author of the book Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. Dr. Lemke is an expert on addiction, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Are you willing to share your experience with this kind of compulsive habit, behavior, whatever you want to call it? Is that something you have now? Maybe with social media, shopping, a substance, the list goes on and on. Did you find a way to break out of it? Love to hear it. If you did, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Lemke, it seems like a challenge here when we're talking about something that, you know, isn't a known dangerous drug, a heroin or something like that. How do we know when we've crossed the line from, hey, this is a thing I like to do and have fun doing, to this is a compulsive overconsumption of this thing?
You need to look for the three C's: control, compulsion, and consequences. So out of control use means using more than we planned or intended to, or more than is consistent with our goals and values, including opportunity costs. So what are the things we're not doing because we're spending so much time doing a particular behavior or a particular drug? Compulsion refers to a lot of our mental real estate now being occupied by thinking about our drug to the exclusion of other things, as well as a level of automaticity around initiating our drug use. And again, I use the term drug very broadly to incorporate behaviors as well. And then most importantly, we want to look for consequences. These can be relationship consequences, work consequences, health consequences, especially continued consequences, use despite consequences. So those are the signs that we look for as people are tipping from recreational or even self-medication kind of use into overuse, compulsive use, and addictive use. Other soft signs to look for are when we start to lead the double life or lie about our consumption to other people. This is very classically happens as people become addicted. They tend to sort of lead, again, this double life where they're not even being honest with themselves about what they're using and how they're spending their time. The other soft sign to look for is to think about and be very mindful of not just how we feel when we're doing our drug, but how we feel afterward. So to take your example of the video games, you can certainly remember the kind of pleasure you initially felt when you were playing video games, but now think about how you felt as you were trying to stop or right after you stopped. That brings into awareness this kind of dopamine free fall that happens when we stop using a highly intoxicating substance or drug.
We're talking to Dr. Anna Lemke about her book, Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are these experiences, are these ideas sounding familiar to you, something you're dealing with now or went through earlier in your life? How did you get through it? Did you find ways to change habits, separate yourself from whatever it is that might have triggered this compulsive overconsumption of you fill in the blank of what? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Dr. Anna Lemke, author of Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your experiences, your questions. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller. Gary is with us in southern Wisconsin. Gary, hello.
Hi there. I have come in an unusual story. I had a tremendous amount of tragedy when I was younger, about 21 years old. My sister was killed in a car accident. I was in the car accident, didn't walk for 2 years, had 14 surgeries. My dad later, a year after that, committed suicide. I was so depressed, I went to a doctor. They misdiagnosed me as schizophrenic and put me on Stelazine. Now, anybody that researches Stelazine knows that it down-regulates dopamine dramatically. And since that period, I've always had trouble with depression. So after many, many years, I've now had over 20 surgeries, and, you know, I try to do what I can to lift my mood, but because of that Stelazine damage to my brain, I always have trouble. I take like L-tyrosine, L-phenylalanine, that type of thing, but I still have PTSD and tremendous pain all the time.
Gary, I'm so sorry you went through all of that, and best to you. Dr. Lemke, obviously we can't diagnose Gary here, but that idea of medications that suppress dopamine, it seems like that would be something we'd want to be really careful with.
Well, it's an interesting call. And yeah, Gary, gosh, I would think what jumps out at me is your incredible resilience at enduring so much life tragedy and coming through the other side. You know, Stelazine is a dopamine receptor antagonist. It's used to treat psychotic disorders like schizophrenia. I'm not aware of any research showing that it leaves a long-lasting dopamine deficit state. You know, it's possible, I suppose, but really typically once people stop taking a medication like Stelazine, it will no longer be blocking those dopamine receptors and shouldn't really leave any long-term residual damage. So, you know, it's hard to know, Gary, whether it's the medicine or whether it's your life tragedies that set you up for depression or whether, you know, there are all the surgeries. I mean, there are so many reasons why, you know, your life has been harder. But it's an interesting point and it's an interesting question, the ways that chemicals that limit dopamine might have some long-lasting effect. Although, again, I'm not aware of any research showing that.
Gary, thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. Martin joins us now in Duluth. Martin, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Martin?
Well, the question of rewarding yourself for breaking a bad habit and whether there's what kind of merit or not merit there is to that. Years ago, when I quit smoking cigarettes, I rewarded myself with buying a lot of expensive camping gear. And I'm assuming that's probably not a bad idea. I just want to hear her comments.
Interesting, Martin. That idea, Dr. Lemke, of replacing that habit we don't want, that addiction, with something better. What do you think?
Right. So there have been a lot of popular books written about doing just what you did, Martin, when trying to give up a bad habit, replace the one reward with another reward, as you did with the buying camping gear. The problem with that is twofold. First of all, there's the risk of cross-addiction, where you could get addicted potentially to shopping. It sounds like you didn't, or at least you didn't elaborate on that. So that's good news. But the other problem with replacing one reward with another is that we're merely just continuing to prime our dopamine reward pathway. Whereas the intervention that I recommend in the book is to actually simply abstain from the highly reinforcing drug or behavior for long enough to reset reward pathways and let dopamine firing come back up to normal baseline levels. Now, obviously, that's easier said than done, but that is the recommendation that I have, as opposed to this idea of replacing rewards, which doesn't quite reset reward pathways and may lead to a new addiction.
Thanks for calling in, Martin, at 800-642-1234. Dr. Lemke, I want to stay with strategies to help get out of these addictions. You talk about this idea in the book of self-binding, not just counting on willpower, which I know wouldn't work for me, but framing our lives, separating ourselves from the temptation. What kind of things are you talking about?
So this is using literal and metacognitive barriers between ourselves and our drug of choice so that we can press the pause button between desire and consumption. So for example, with a video game addiction, this would mean eliminating all of the video games from our various devices. Maybe if we have some kind of game console, putting that away for the 4-week period of the dopamine fast, long enough to reset reward pathways so that we can really then engage our willpower more successfully and not exhaustively. With a food addiction, this would involve getting that food of choice out of the house and only keeping the kind of healthier foods that we're wanting to eat. With a more typical cannabis or alcohol or other drug use disorder, this would mean, getting that drug out of the house, and also generally avoiding people, places, and things that might trigger us to use our drug. What's really interesting about triggers is that they also release dopamine, and we get a little bit high just thinking about or being reminded of our drug of choice, followed by a little mini dopamine deficit state, which is the state of craving, which then motivates us to use. So part of overcoming any kind of addiction means not just insulating ourselves from the actual drug, but also insulating ourselves to the extent possible from reminders or triggers of the drug.
We are talking to Dr. Anna Lemke, addiction expert, author of the book Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. We heard on Twitter from Leah, who writes, "Tanning was my addiction through high school and college, using tanning beds." Leah says, "I love the quick dopamine and results it would provide. I've since stopped tanning and have accepted my natural skin tone, and I'm healthier for it," she writes. That idea of accepting life without whatever addiction is, Dr. Lemke, can you talk about that?
Yeah. So first of all, thanks, Leah. I love that you brought this up because it really does speak to the ways in which we can get addicted to many different types of reinforcers. And in the case of tanning beds, it's not just the look that probably was reinforcing or potentially addictive, but probably it was the physiologic response you got from the tanning itself. So the chemical boost, the little dopamine hit you got from the tanning. So I think, a big part of recovery from any addiction or compulsive overconsumption is readjusting ourselves to a life that's not full of these highs and lows, but somewhere in between. A patient of mine who had a very severe opioid addiction and who got into recovery and was grateful for his recovery, but missed some of the drama and excitement of his addicted life, actually turned toward tabletop games where he could assume certain characters and engage in excitement through the drama of the tabletop game rather than in his real life, which was more drama than he needed or wanted. Sometimes we encourage patients to do sort of secretly radical things to allow them to adjust to the sometimes boring, a nature of everyday life. And this can be things like just wearing really exciting underwear or something like that.
Time for one more caller. Laura is with us in McHenry, Illinois. Laura, hi.
Yes, hi. I was calling to find out if this dopamine situation might have any relationship to a person who is a hoarder, where in the acquisition of the items that they tend to hoard, that there's the satisfaction, there's, a high that they kind of get out of it.
Laura, thanks for the call. We don't have a lot of time left, but Dr. Lemke, I'm guessing the answer is yes. Dopamine could be part of that acquiring and keeping stuff, hoarding.
Oh, most certainly. So that cycle of acquisition and the anticipation and pleasure we get from collecting things and keeping things definitely involves dopamine. In the book, I talk about a patient who got addicted to buying things on Amazon, went into thousands of dollars in debt, had rooms full of keychains, sunglasses, and mugs he didn't need. And for him, it was the process of acquisition, choosing the item, waiting for it to come. The moment he opened it and got it, he went into a severe dopamine deficit state withdrawal and then was back on the computer again looking for the next thing.
Thanks for that call, Laura. In our last minute or so, Dr. Lemke, part of the point in your book is it's really easy for us to find the things that make us feel good and then they stop making us feel good. You suggest we lean into the rest of life, the parts that don't always feel so good. How can we do that?
Well, what we've found is that by pressing on the pain side of the balance, which is to say doing things intentionally that are difficult, like exercise, ice cold water plunges, or anything that requires iterative endurance, attention, and effort, is a way to get dopamine indirectly. Because what we're doing when we expose ourselves to mild to moderate, noxious, or toxic stimuli, which actually exercise is, for example, is that we're telling our bodies, oh, there's an injury here, it's time to upregulate or make more of the feel-good neurotransmitters like dopamine, serotonin, and norepinephrine. So it turns out that intentionally inviting hard things into your life is a great way to get dopamine without going into a dopamine deficit state. Obviously, you don't want to overdo it. Mm-hmm. It is possible to get addicted to pain, but in general, this is a very good strategy.
Dr. Lemke, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, and thanks to the callers.
That's Dr. Anna Lemke, professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford University. She talked to us about her book, Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence. It came out in paperback this month. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. First, do you ever have brilliant ideas in the shower or solve a problem while you're taking a walk or doing the dishes? Research actually backs up this phenomenon of common tasks boosting our creativity. It's sometimes called the shower effect. You know, when Archimedes had that eureka moment in the bathtub and discovered the principle of buoyancy, he's probably benefiting from the shower effect, or in his case, the bathtub effect. We're taking a look at the science behind those shower moments, how we can use them to be more creative. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. When do you have your best ideas? Have you had this kind of moment? You're beating your head against a wall trying to solve a problem at work, around the house, and then you step away from it and do something different, and then the answer comes to you? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Richard Sema is the Brain Matters columnist at the Washington Post's Well-Being Desk, covering the neuroscience of everyday life. He was a neuroscience researcher for years before becoming a journalist. Richard, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rob.
Before we dig into the research, and there is research on this, you write, let's talk about creativity a bit. People might think creativity, that's, you know, writing a song, writing a book, painting a picture, whatever. Creativity pops up a lot in our lives, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's anything that gets you out of your normal everyday thinking about both what you're working on, but also like how you enjoy yourselves. Like, I always think of like when I was a kid and just being outside playing with sticks and having imaginary sword fights. And, you know, like you could apply creative thinking to how you have fun, as well as like how you plan social events. Also, if you have something to like problem solve at work, it's good to think outside the box.
And I do this sometimes, you know, I'm staring at a screen trying to write a, say, a radio script or something like that. and I stare and stare and get nothing done. And then I just walk around the halls for a few minutes and then it sorts itself out and I can go back and start writing. Do you have things like that in your own life?
Oh, definitely. I definitely take advantage of long showers when I'm also writing and not really sure how to explain something, and just sitting in the shower, it seems to just percolate up while I'm like washing my hair or something, which is nice. And as you mentioned, there's like research backing this up where they had physicists and writers write down their most creative ideas every day. And it turns out 20% of these thoughts came during showers or while they're doing chores away from their desk. And it's pretty amazing to me. And also the researchers mentioned, like, how many other things can you do as well in the shower or doing chores as you can at work?
And there's research looking at what's going on in our brain, sometimes pretty creative research. What kind of things are out there that have illustrated, you know, how this works?
Yeah, so this shower effect is the product of what psychologists called mind wandering, which is basically when your thoughts are anywhere else besides the task you're currently doing. And so mind wandering could be negative, right? Like you could be like going into rumination or like dark thoughts, but it really depends on what you're thinking about. And there's research showing that if you mind wander about something you're interested in, you can be happier and in some cases more creative. So there is one study that was like, you know, basically looking at what kinds of activities people are doing while they're mind wandering. And there's a sweet spot. It's like if the activity is moderately engaging, people were more likely to have creative outputs for an experiment. Because it seems like if you're doing something that is engaging your attention, giving your mind something to sort of like stimulate it, something to nosh on, that was good for the creative process. But if it was something really boring, then they were completely like off task. They were thinking about other things that didn't really matter, weren't really creative. Right, but if it's also something too engaging, you don't have enough mind space to think about those ideas that you are percolating in the back of your mind.
Right. So staring at a wall isn't going to help. That's too boring. If I'm playing a super intense video game, that's probably occupying, I guess, what, too much of my mind to come up with that creative solution?
Yeah, exactly. You're probably too engaged about, you know, your Mario jump puzzle and not really having much to like think about what you're writing about.
We're talking to Richard Sima with the Washington Post Well-Being Desk, looking at the shower moment, how to harness creativity, our problem-solving skills, by stepping away from the problem itself, taking a shower, going for a walk, that some kind of activity can help us percolate, develop our solution, our creativity. Do you have something like this? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. However you use creativity, at home, at work, whatever, are there things that you do to get away from the problem and come up with a solution? By doing something else, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi, Rob. Ah, that shower moment, it's all wet.
No, but anyway, seriously, Dennis.
Sometimes what happens is I'll be listening to something, and it connects with what I've been thinking about, whether it's something from the previous day or the current day. Have you ever heard of the Ideas Network of Public Radio?
I have. Dennis, do you get those serendipity moments where something connects like that?
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. Dennis, thanks a lot. Richard, like reaching out to some other form, you know, if you're doing computer code, listening to music or something like that, are there ways to maybe get that serendipitous inspiration that Dennis finds?
Yeah, that's an amazing example. And I'm glad that Dennis called in about that because, yeah, it's like these moments allow you to have more stimulation that you wouldn't otherwise probably get if you're just sitting at your desk. Going back to that first study, looking at the physicists and the writers and the ideas that they had while they're not working, a lot of those ideas were actually more of these aha moments, these eureka breakthroughs on something that they were struggling with. It seems like if you're doing something else, you are going to be in a different mind space. You are going to have different stimulation. So, of course, your mind will produce different thoughts than if you're just in the same exact desk working on the same exact problem in the same exact way.
Dennis, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Okay, there's research you write about from, I think, almost exactly a year ago about what's happening in our brains we're being creative. And this is a pretty wild study. Can you tell us about this?
Yeah, so basically, researchers have been looking for a while at what happens in the brain when we are both mind-wandering and also when we're doing something creative. So in the brain, there's a network of different brain regions called the default mode network, which is activated when we are thinking inward. You know, we're daydreaming or we're mind wandering. You know, we're not paying as much attention to the outside world. And there's been a lot of evidence showing that this default mode network in the brain is, you know, really good for creativity. And last year in January, we had the first, experiment that demonstrated if you disrupt this default mode network, you have, you are able to disrupt creativity. So, you know, this group at the University of Utah had patients who were going in for brain surgery because they had tumors, which, you know, it allows for the very rare opportunity to like stimulate their brains, which is part of routine surgery. And they had the patients do what's this classic creativity task called the alternate use task. You give them, you know, a standard item like a brick or a pencil, and you ask how many different ways can you use this in weird, novel like settings. And so, you know, the patients, when they weren't having their default mode network disrupted, they were able to be like, yeah, a tire, you could use it as a cushion, you could use it as a garden fountain, you could cut it up as jewelry. But when they stimulated this default mode network, you know, they asked this one patient, what can you do with a pencil? She struggled. She was like, you could draw with it. You can draw cartoons, mostly draw. And, you know, after they stopped stimulating and like inhibiting the default mode network, she was able to get it back. But it showed that this network seems really important for, you know, this divergent out of the box thinking.
Let's bring on another caller at 800-642-1234. Meg is with us in Hudson. Meg, hello.
Hello. I have to say that when you were talking about being creative in the shower, it's kind of embarrassing to admit, but I was a reporter for 30 years and I did a lot of writing, and that's where I wrote all the best opening graphs and my best columns while I was taking a shower. So being all wet is a good thing.
Now, Meg, you can't write it down while you do it. Were you able to retain after you had that inspiration long enough to get over to the whatever notepad or computer and get it on paper?
Yeah, but that's why I had to retire, because my memory started to go. So,
oh, okay.
But no, I was able to retain it, and I was always amused by the fact that the most responses I got to my columns were usually the ones that were pretty much predominantly written in the shower. So,
no kidding, Meg. Thanks a lot for sharing that. Yeah, Richard. I mean, do you have some advice on how to harness that so people can figure out to do what Meg did?
Yeah, there's some people who recommend getting waterproof notebooks so you could write it down. Because, like, yeah, you know, you're there, you're having the thoughts, and you don't always know when it's going to come up. Might as well have something close at hand. I know there's a story, like, Carl Sagan, a, you know, really prominent science communicator, used to, like, draw on the fog of the shower and maybe write down what, you know, he wrote there afterwards. But, yeah, there's some ways to harness it more directly. But yeah, I haven't taken that extra step. I also have shower thoughts and just scramble to my notepad or my computer afterwards to quickly jot down that great like idea or graph before it disappears.
Meg, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Glenn is with us now on the road. Glenn, hi.
Well, hello. How are we doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about or ask about?
Well, I got to hear part of Meg's comments, which is I just want to reiterate the same thing. Like, I could be laying in bed or I could be taking a walk, nothing, but as soon as I get in the shower, that's where all the ideas come. And I was wondering if there's been a study done about water, because I really do feel like it has something to do with water.
Interesting, Glenn. Is there something about the sound, the feel of water, Richard? I don't know if there's been research on that yet.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything directly that I know of testing, you know, whether it's the sound or the feel or like just it being just a pleasant experience for most people, the warmth. There's nothing that I know of, but I think that's a good place to look. One thought is that, you know, it is, you know, providing a very different context. Like, you're usually not wet, you're usually clothed during the day. So you're in a completely different mind state because you are experiencing completely different things than you normally are. So maybe that has something to do with it, but the water angle would be really interesting to look at.
Definitely. Glenn, thanks a lot for the question. We're talking to Richard Sima, Brain Matters columnist at the Washington Post Well-Being Desk, talking to us about the science of creativity, why everyday tasks can help boost it. Things like maybe you have great ideas in the shower or doing the dishes or out for a walk or, well, you tell us. Call 800-642-1234. Where do you go when you need to come up with an idea to solve a problem? Do you just grind it out, keep plugging away at it, or do you need to step away and do something different? What is that something different? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Washington Post columnist Richard Sima about the science of creativity, the research finding that there's a reason you have better ideas in the shower or maybe while doing household chores or walking or a lot of things we could find those creative solutions. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have something like this? Have you had great ideas in the shower or are there things you do to break up your work day or your creativity where you go away from it, and that's where you get your good ideas? Call 800-642-1234 and tell us about it or ask your questions about the neuroscience of creativity. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Back to your calls now. Russ is with us on the road. Russ, hi.
Hey, nice to talk to you. Well, I guess I'll throw a little water on the whole deal about showers. I get my best ideas when I wake up in the morning. I kind of linger there laying in bed. It's like my mind has been kind of working on it subconsciously. And so it comes to light. I get up and I go to it.
I get that sometimes too. Now, yeah. Are you able to do things like you're able to hop out of bed and put it into action, Richard, right away? Because my worry is, again, if I dawdle too long, then I eat breakfast and make the coffee, I forget about it.
Yeah, yeah, I get right to it. I've been inventing novel ways to make third houses specifically for Purple Martins. And so I go right down to my workshop and start putting it into action.
Excellent. Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Russ. Richard, you had some thoughts.
Yeah, that's really cool, Russ. Actually, that is probably going to be a follow-up piece about how sleeping on it does actually work for creativity, because there is research showing that your mind does work on these open loop questions. Like, you haven't solved something. It's still in your subconscious working on in the background. So if you go to sleep with that question in mind, you might wake up with a solution or something new to play with, when you wake up. And I think a similar maybe piece of advice is like your phone is there if you want to jot it down before you get out of bed, or something to write it down just so you don't, you know, have it dissipate when you wake up fully.
And thanks a lot for sharing that, Russ. I want to contrast that with dreaming, because sometimes I think we wake up and think we had this brilliant ideas in a dream. And then, you know, if we write it down in the morning, it's like ninja penguin tablecloth or something like that, right? Our dreaming isn't really necessarily going to solve our problems.
Yeah, not necessarily. But it's interesting because I was actually talking with my mother about this, and she's a programmer, and she brought up that she could actually do computer coding in her dreams. And I asked her, do you actually get to use any of the code? And she's like, yeah, like I solve a lot of problems this way. And
wow.
I was kind of amazed. So I guess your mileage may vary. I certainly don't have that ability.
Thanks a lot for that call. Bob joins us now in Lake Nabogamon. Sorry, Bob. Thanks a lot for calling in.
Nabogamon.
Thank you. What did you want to tell us
Northern
about?
Northern Wisconsin. I think a lot of this is related to theta wave activity. T-H-E-T-A. It's when you lay in bed in the morning, sometimes when you go to sleep at night, sometimes in the shower, you're really creative. And I think that is what a lot of this is. It's at times when you feel safe and relaxed and you're pondering something in the theta wave activity. It's close to sleep.
Interesting. Bob, I don't know much about theta waves. Do you come across this in your line of work?
I'm a nurse anesthetist, and I've been putting people to sleep and waking them up for 35 years.
Ah.
And some of our medicines will negate theta wave activity. Some of it kind of enhances it. And I've had many, many patients just look at me and go, wow, I know that they were in some theta wave activity because something in their life came fresh to them. You know what I mean?
Interesting, Bob. Thanks for sharing that perspective. Richard, I don't know. Is there research out there about the theta waves in the brain? I'm not even sure what they are, and our creativity.
Yeah, so that's a really interesting insight and line of thinking. But basically, it's a type of brainwave activity, and it's the frequency at which, you know, you have these spikes of brain activity. And I believe theta waves are really fast spiking and seems to correlate with when there's a lot of neural activity. You know, when you're sleeping, it's usually slower, except in certain cases, like during REM sleep, where you have a lot of this fast bursting theta waves. And I believe there's some research showing that this type of brain wave activity is really important for processing information, making memories, and, you know, certain types of learning. So I could definitely see that this could be involved with creativity, though I'm currently not sure what the research is on that, but that's my general knowledge, that these different brain waves, theta is really important for this type of thinking.
Thanks a lot for the call, Bob. Mike joins us now in Milwaukee. Mike, hi.
Hi, this is Mike.
Yeah, go ahead. What did you want to tell us about, Mike?
Well, I work in manufacturing. I've done that for decades, and over the years have made the observation that when struggling with a, let's say, equipment problem, something that you just can't get working properly, and I'll break for lunch, and then notice that when I get back from lunch, I can see the issue and clearer, and usually get things resolved. And it's really amazing. It's like, is there a connection? Is it the gut-brain connection, or is it just a distraction of being away from the, you know, the problem, and you're looking away, just like what you're talking about.
Interesting.
But I think that there could be the gut-brain connection there that could be helping out as well.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Richard, what do you think? Is it the eating or the stepping away that's helping Mike solve these problems?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's a gut-brain connection, though. I don't know if that's been looked at, mm-hmm. but I definitely think the stepping away is helpful because your brain is still working on it even when you're not like explicitly thinking about it. There's some really interesting research from over a century ago by like a Russian psychologist showing that if you give people problems to solve and you interrupt some of the problems, they are more likely to remember the problems that were interrupted than the ones that they actually solved. So it seems like your brain is holding on to those unfinished questions and probably working on it while you're on your lunch break.
Mike, thanks a lot for that call. Richard, in our last minute, it seems like there's a practical takeaway. I think one mode of thinking is when you're in school, you nose to the book, keep plugging away. You're at work, you know, grind for 12 hours a day. It seems like recess and lunch breaks and all those things really are actually going to make us more productive.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I don't always practice it because it feels like, oh, if I just sit there, I will figure it out. But no, I think the research is pretty clear that if you can take a break, you should allow yourself to take that break. You know, it relieves your stress, which puts in, you in a better mental state, but also gives you like a break from a set mode of thinking. And if you get a change of scenery, you might get different stimulation to your brain, which leads to different thoughts, which might lead to a different solution to the problems that you've been having. And one final thing is just, I would encourage people to think about what experiences, what settings seem to really help you personally for being in this creative mode of thinking. You know, all our minds are different. So what gives us that relaxed, you know, mind wandering, mind meandering state is going to be different for you than for someone else. But you have the ability to think about what that is for you and try to use it.
Richard, thanks for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, this was great, Rob. Thank you.
That's Richard Sima, the Brain Matters columnist at the Washington Post Well-Being Desk, covering the science, a neuroscience of everyday life. He talked to us about some of the science behind creativity and these so-called shower moments, when we step away, do something different, and then come up with our creative solutions to problems. Thanks for all your calls. And you can keep sharing those, by the way, if you have something like that, the thing you go and do to help you be creative, to figure out that problem you've been mulling over at work or at home all day. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.